We'll start this session with a refuge in Bodhicitta prayer. That is in the beginning of the Chenrezig practice.
Sanje Chedan Tsochi Chonama Chanchu Padu Dani Jasu Dagi Jin So Ji Pe Sunam Ji Dula Penchi Sanje Drupa Sho Sanje Dasa ki chab nam la jan chu padu dat ni jau su chi Dat ji jin so ji pe so nam ji dro la pen chi san ye dro pa sho Sanje Chodam Sochi Chodam La Janche Padu Dagni Jasuchi Dagi Jin Sochi Pe Sonam Ji Drala Penche Sanje Drupasho
So to continue from where we left off this morning, I'm talking about people who waste their entire lives in negative activities and think they've done good because they gave tea to a monastery for one morning. So I think we're at the same, and here's the paragraph that begins, top of page 5. The way they have come under the control of ego clinging and desire. There's no need to speak of them being liberated in the misdeeds, lack of inherent existence. First of all, they haven't even heard that misdeeds ripen as rebirth in the lower realms in the next life. Even if they have heard, they do not think of it. Instead, without shrinking from ill repute in this life and suffering in the next, they are able to sacrifice everything, their body, their life, and dharma, if it seems they might gain some riches. They deserve our compassion. This is the epitome of wallowing in the causes of suffering. So I think the point here, when he talks about not realizing, one moment, little spider. He doesn't want to go onto the paper, so I'm going to have to be patient. Instead of, here it says, no need to speak of them being liberated in the misdeeds, lack of inherent existence. A lot of people say, oh, everything's emptiness. We do Mahamudra practice, it's all just the play of the nature of the mind. It doesn't matter what we can do. Because it's all just Mahamudra anyways. Yeah, we can go out and drink. It's fine. But we shouldn't overestimate our own abilities. A lot of the things that are talked about in, you know, you read crazy stories about the great Mahasiddhas of India or of the people who have gone into yogic conduct and do outrageous activity, and even some stories from more recent times. But if we haven't got the level of realization of the people who can actually do it, we're actually not doing anything other than just indulging our own desires. So we have to be very careful about our actions, because when you do negative actions, it disturbs your mind. This is why they're negative. They lead to suffering in the future because they disturb your mind. They go against everything we're trying to do. When you think about, I mean, not just the negative actions, but, you know, you think about oh, I don't know, drinking and partying and carousing and all this. And alcohol on its own is neutral. But people do really stupid things when they're drunk, consistently. And so this is why you should be really careful of your conduct, and not try to overestimate yourself. In other words, we cannot act as if we were advanced yogis when we're beginners. The fox who leaps where the lion leapt will break his back. The lion can jump across a huge chasm because the lion is big, the fox is small. The fox is just going to fall into the abyss and, you know, break his neck. So we're like the little foxes. So we have to be careful about what we do. And it's important not to give up. You need to really keep your, what this is really saying is keep your priorities straight. So we need to see, you know, here, again, like I was saying earlier today, we, in this culture, we generally have a pretty high standard of conduct. It's not at all like Tibet, where people were wandering around with swords and knives and getting into fights and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And just, even until very recent times, and in eastern Tibet, even until recently, you couldn't go around without a sword of your own, because, you know, you're going to get attacked by someone who has a sword. And if you don't have a sword, you're done. We had that, we called it the Wild West mentality. It's like a mentality that, at least as far as other white people, ended with the 19th century. Maybe not with other people of other races. But we, in our own daily lives, we don't do that much. But what we do is a lot of the time is we wallow in slight negativity and distraction. You know, we're not going out and doing the out and out. I mean, none of us are carrying swords around. Maybe you're packing pistols and have a concealed weapon permit. I don't know. But I better be careful what I say. But it's the small actions, and so you have to be able to distinguish: are you acting out of a virtuous intention or not? Are your actions good or not? Because we're not doing it. Generally, we're not doing anything that's manifestly or obviously wrong. We're doing we do the small acts, and those add up. There are a couple of things that make an action difficult to confess and purify, and one of them is doing them frequently. There's some sort of small one thing that makes it difficult to confess and purify an action is if you do it frequently, even if it's a small action. If you get in the habit of doing it, much harder to get out of the habit. It's like cigarettes are a pretty small habit with bag of negative consequences, but once you get the habit, it's a hard one to break. And the same thing with, probably even worse, when you talk about talking badly about other people. Gossip. Very bad habit, very easy to get into, and very hard to get out of. I've been to some present-day monasteries, Klotowa says, and asked them how many fine individuals they have there. They say there are a few. When I ask what they're like, they do not say they are learned, venerable, good, endowed with ethic qualities or realized, or that they benefit others greatly. I ask who they are, and they tell me about individuals who have gold and turquoise, horses and cattle, farms and property, who have this many retainers and servants or that many possessions. They are the lifeblood of the monastery. The one named this and the one named that are good people, they say. What they call being good is being wealthy. So they must be desirous and interested only in this life. Being very wealthy is usually a sign of not shying away from misdeeds, suffering, or ill repute. Such a monastery could never be a setting for true Dharma practice. You should leave that place just as a bird leaves a lake when it freezes. So, of course, he's talking about monasteries in 12th century or 11th century Tibet, but we see this a lot around, you know, is the Dharma Center a social club? Or are we the people there, are you there really to practice? Is this Dharma Center a social club? You guys know the answer. Or are you here to practice? You know, this is what you have to look and see. Nowadays, I mean, this is not like 11th century Tibet. It's not like you can put on red robes and walk around Portland and get given a lot of gifts by people and then gather students and retainers and things like that by looking like an important monk. But, you know, are you going to go out and, you know, make something of yourself for being a little bit more than what you are? So it's important to, you know, leave places such as this, like a bird leaves a frozen lake. Generally, this attachment and greed for the five sensory pleasures leads to lasting suffering in the end. Thus, even if you were to help others a little, you would need the result to come to you in this life, and there would be no difference between you and all those who have not even turned their attention toward philosophy. So we think that we're doing something better by doing Dharma practice. But what is our aim out of the Dharma practice that we're doing? It's very easy for us to get a little bit corrupted and not even realize it. So you just have to continually watch it beyond. This is really all about being honest with yourself. Not coming under the control of what we call the eight worldly concerns. You shouldn't care whether you get something or don't. Usually people are happy to get things and disappointed when they either lose them or when they don't get things. You get something nice, you get a raise at work, you get a bonus, someone gives you a gift, you're happy, brings you pleasure. You lose some money, you don't get the bonus that you expected, and you get unhappy about it. That's the first set of worldly concerns, being pleased at gain and displeased at losing things. We're happy when people say nice things about me, about us. You're happy when people say nice things about me too, aren't you? We're happy when people say nice things about ourselves. People say, oh, you're so nice, you're so good, you're so like this and that. That makes us happy. And we're really displeased when people say bad things about ourselves, or they criticize us. Actually, it should be the other way around. When people say good things about you, it's rarely helpful. When people say bad things about you, actually, it's often extremely helpful. Far more helpful than being praised. We really should appreciate being criticized and hate being praised, but we're always the other way around. Because when people criticize you, there's usually at least a smidgen of something that's right about what they're saying. It's not like, you know, they're seeing something about you that you're not seeing or that you're not willing to admit or that you don't just never thought of. And even if there's only 10% truth in their criticism, at least that 10% truth is something that you can act on. Someone says, oh, you're wonderful, that was great. So what? I mean, you can't do anything to improve yourself after that. That was wonderful, so what? I mean, yeah, what? It's not helpful. Being praised is not helpful. So this is the second set of the eight worldly concerns, kind of in four sets of two. So the first is being pleased at gain and displeased at loss. The second is being pleased at praise and being displeased with criticism. We're in American culture especially, we praise each other excessively. I mean, it's like, oh, that was so wonderful. You're just wonderful. It's amazing. It's like, great. It's like, and you see kids, you're special, and you're special. Everyone is special. Everyone is special. That means the only people who are not, the people who are really special are the people who are ordinary. Because everyone else is special. And, you know, we get really attached to being praised, and we encourage people to really look for praise, and then we're upset about praise and blame. In fact, this is one of the areas, I think, where we get a lot of conflict in our lives comes from looking for praise and being unhappy about being criticized. Not only does it give us problems in this life, it prevents us from practicing the Dharma. And then we have feelings we have to process. So that's the second, is the praise, blame. Being happy about pleasure and unhappy about pain. So usually when things are pleasurable, okay, we'll go through the same list. Gelato, coffee, good coffee, Arabica. We've had enough of this speckled axe, we're going back to Arabica. A mocha cappuccino, or whatever it is. And whatever it is that gives us, we're happy about having pleasure, and we're unhappy about pain or discomfort. And so we do what we can to get what causes, what we think will cause us pleasure, and to avoid what would bring us displeasure. So that's the third set. And then the fourth set is being pleased at fame and being displeased at being anonymous, or basically obscured, or even worse, being notorious. Well, actually, some people like being notorious, as is probably fairly clear at this point. I'm trying to avoid politics, really. But fame, you know, I think, you know, the text, this is always translated as fame, but I always kind of think that really the way we should translate it for our actual situations is popularity. We want to be popular, we don't want to be nobodies. Everyone always wants to be liked. So when people like you and they pop in, everyone says, oh, so-and-so is such a great person, and they're talking about you, it's like, you know, it's not like we all want to go out and be like a...
Kardashian.
What? Kardashians, yeah.
I wanted to help you out because I knew that part.
Yeah, no, that's a good I was trying to think of... I was trying to think of Justin Bieber.
Oh.
We want to be like Justin Bieber, but we don't want to be like that swimmer Ryan Lochte, or how do you say his name?
Lochte.
So that's popular versus obscure, popular versus notorious. There are different ways of understanding. So these are the eight worldly concerns. And basically, most of the worldly things we do are motivated by one of these eight worldly concerns. And that's why they're called the worldly concerns. I mean, you can think about it with respect to your own lives, and how much do you do out of a motivation for basically wanting to get something good for yourself and keep the bad stuff away. How much of what you do is out of that sort of dualistic get the good and eliminate the bad. We want the gelato. We don't want dog poop. To a fly, they're equally delicious. To a dog, they're equally delicious. To us, they aren't. There's nothing inherent about gelato that would be delicious. There's nothing inherent about dog poop that would not be delicious. But don't serve it to me, because I haven't got to that level of practice yet. Besides, it's after lunch, I'm okay till next year. Right, so these eight worldly concerns, and these are, they come up over and over again. If you read the life of Milarepa, or the 100,000 songs of Milarepa, you'll see these, the eight worldly concerns talked about over and over again. Impermanence, eight worldly concerns. Of course, there's a lot about Mahamudra and view and things like that, but really, what is it that's going to be helpful for us now? Like it says in the first paragraph that I started reading from, there's no need to speak of them being liberated in the misdeeds' lack of inherent existence. We don't have the view of emptiness. We don't have the view of Mahamudra. We need to get there. And so to get there, we have to start out working with what we can. That's looking at our own lives as texts, but also being critical about them and being, not critical in the sense of criticizing, but using our critical faculties, like a critical thinking sort of critical. So being, what is going on in our lives? To what degree am I acting out of attachment or aversion? To what degree am I acting out of just delusion, ignorance, not caring about things? And when you can really start looking at your life in that way, then you can start making the progress towards overcoming the eight worldly concerns. So this is why it's so important to start at the beginning and to go step by step by step. To recognize, like I've said already several times today, we start with the four thoughts that turn the mind, and we have to really contemplate them over and over again. We need to think about what these eight worldly concerns are. When you read a lot of Dharma texts about Abhidharma texts, we all like to read the sort of feel-good, Dharma text with stories about our neighbors. When you get to the heavy philosophy that's like saying there are 51 mental factors, the five universal, the five that recognize the object and so forth, we get bored because we're often not really thinking about how does this apply to ourselves. So actually, it's important also, and when you do study, of course it's good to study the texts by modern authors who write in ways that you can understand. But it's also important to try to, if you've been reading only those texts for years, it's also good to try to take a step up and take a look at, well, what are some of these traditional texts, traditional philosophy texts, and what are they talking about? And they may seem really dry until you start looking at, well, what is actually going on in my own head, and does this apply? Like if you read this book and it's just, I'm reading philosophy about someone else, it's not going to make any difference. If you read this book, and when it talks about, when Dharmakirti and Chudakyasa talk about the truth of suffering, and you think, okay, it says, suffering is the samsaric aggregates. What does that mean? Samsaric aggregates, the five aggregates, the form, feeling, conception, formation, and consciousness. These are everything that we think of ourselves of as ourselves and as others. All the physical forms, all of the different mental states. And so this is all the truth of suffering. So how are they suffering? So like Tracy was asking this morning, why that you have all these problems and things that come up, all the mental suffering. So how is it that all of the aggregates are suffering? You need to look at it for yourselves. If you start looking at it like that way, it sort of takes the step from being just dry philosophy that doesn't mean anything to you to actually being something that can change your life. Generally, this attachment and greed for the five sensory pleasures leads to lasting suffering in the end. Thus, even if you were to help others a little, you would need the result to come in this life, and there would be no difference between you and all those who have not turned their attention toward philosophy. Therefore, anyone who wants to practice Dharma should not expect any favors or reciprocation in return for helping others. Who would then think they needed to repay the favor. they failed to reciprocate, it's possible that you would get angry, and then they would feel ashamed or inadequate and go astray. Anyone who wants to practice should not give even their fellow practitioners food with the strings of this life attached. If others give it to you, do not eat it. In the end, it will become a back and forth of food that will eventually cause you to lose the Dharma. So you have some Dharma Center get together, and someone brings something really nice, and if you, and they're saying, "Oh, I brought something really nice last time." That's your turn. When you bring something nice to the Dharma Center and share it, when you bring something nice to anywhere, you're making a gift. And the gift is to give it away, and it doesn't matter what the other person does in return. So this is our normal way of acting in the world is to, when we make a gift, is we expect something back. And, you know, and then we're brought up, you know, it's like my mother's, my mother taught me at an early age that when you give the cookie tin back, it has to have something in it, more cookies. Which is a very nice thing to do, but on the other hand, if then someone gives you back your cookie tin empty, how do you feel? You know? So it's, you have to be, again, it's looking at this. Do we have attachment in this life? The attachment in this greed of the five sensory pleasures leads to lasting suffering in the end. Because the five sensory pleasures on their own, that'd be form, scent, taste, touch, and I'm missing one. Touch. Hearing. Hearing. Yes. Sounds. Form, sound, taste, touch, and hearing. And I'm missing one again.
Smell.
All five of them. They're neutral. But when you smell that perfume, you think to this, "Oh, what scent is this? It's so nice. Samsara perfume." You know, it's like, and then you want it. And then because of your desire for something, or you desire, you want to have fresh seafood on your plate. You want that fresh lobster. And of course, the fresh lobster, you got to put it in the pot while it's still alive and kill it. I'm assuming that most of you are Buddhists by now. At any rate, this is Bain, and I'm Buddhist. I can say it. In order to satisfy your craving for that sensory pleasure of lobster with melted butter staring up at you on the plate. Those antennas no longer wiggling, but cooked and delicious. You want that sensory experience of taste, and in order to get it, you do negative acts. It's easier to see with lobster. I mean, with a lot of food, we don't see the negative acts, or we don't directly incur them ourselves, or commit them ourselves directly. But they are. I mean, it's any food that we eat, something has been killed to make it even organic. Unfortunately. So it's hard to be completely pure. I mean, we're in an internet, in a web of things. So later on, when a tiger comes to eat you, remember all of the tigers that, you know, all of the beings that you have eaten, you know. I guess that's not too likely here, when the great white shark comes off of Portland. But actually, it's really the attachments. Now, a lot of people come to Dharma centers. You know, we're reading this text. It's all talking about attachment and greed. There's very little bit about anger here. And one of the big problems that people always ask about at teachings, especially abroad, is I'm having problems with my emotions. I get angry really easily. So think about, what do you get angry about? You get angry about the things that you're attached to. If you weren't attached to anything, you wouldn't care. You wanted, you know, when you're a little kid, you want that last cookie. You're attached to that last cookie, and someone else gets it, and you're angry. that's kind of a simplistic example, but this is the way it is. You know, we're attached to something, we either lose what we've had or we don't get what we want, and as a result, we get angry. So does our attachment to those things. So if you want to decrease your anger, decrease your attachments. If you don't care, and in fact, if that other person takes that last cookie or that last thing, you should rejoice in it. Lovely. They've enjoyed it. How wonderful. So train yourself in the opposite of attachment, giving. Generosity is really important. I'm going to continue reading a little bit. Furthermore, instead of bringing their minds to the Dharma, all practitioners gather wealth for fear of being badly off in old age. They make people feel good and look for some insurance. This comes from not developing certainty in the Dharma. If you believe in the Dharma, there is no better insurance than Dharma. If you practice Dharma properly, you will have no fear of being badly off when you are old. So this morning we contemplated people in nursing homes or people who are suffering from old age. And I think it's good to return to that contemplation for a few minutes. And think about, think of people whom you know who've been in nursing homes or getting old and having difficulties, who have no problems with money. They have everything they need. And yet they're still subject to tremendous suffering. And the suffering of aging is just difficult to conceive. So please take a few moments. Bring to mind someone whom you know, someone close or someone not so close. Does people's money save them from the suffering of old age? And then bring the contemplation to yourself when you are old and you're debilitated. Will money make you happy? When you're unable to get out of bed on your own power? When you can't do the things that you like to do? For people who don't have Dharma practice, it's obviously better to be wealthy when you're old. But if you do have Dharma practice, it doesn't make much difference. And in our society, when you get old and you're put in a nursing home, your kids live far away, if you have kids. Maybe you have a few friends who come to visit you. The nursing homes can be a very difficult place for a lot of people. Tibetans, when they get old, they don't expect to be able to do anything. They know that if they live to be old enough, they're just going to sit in the corner and they have a mani wheel. They're going to recite Om Mani Padme Hum, and their goal in life when they're at that age is to just recite 100 million mani mantras. They recite as many as they can. They've got dharma to help them, and we don't have that in our culture. We have that ourselves individually, though. We can have it if we take the chance. If you want to do something that's going to help yourself in old age, so stop worrying about old age now and to start practicing the Dharma, because that's what's going to make the difference. If you can get to the point where you really are not attached at all to this life, you don't care about this life, and you are able to engage then in the Dharma practice that will really benefit you, it won't matter to you when you're old. But if we don't take this chance now while we're young enough to do something about it, who knows where we're going to be? None of us are getting any younger. I mean, I've known several of you for now, what, since 1998? 18 years? And so what have we done in the 18 years? How many more years do we have left? Generally, if we consider those who seem to have confidence that they will live to old age and have the ambition to do something that might help themselves at this time, in the next lifetime, they definitely will experience only the sufferings of samsara. They should make ready some provisions, insurance, or anything that will help with their ambitions for the next life. Instead, they simply act as if old age in this life will happen only to them, and the suffering of the next life solely to their hostile enemies. Not even Dharma practitioners have thought this through. Not having contemplated the Dharma, they only bring pointless suffering upon everyone, themselves and others. Who could bear to think about them still being like that? The suffering of old age in this life might seem like a long time until you look back and think, okay, so I've known many of you for 18 years and it doesn't seem like all that long, really. 18 years is not very long. The suffering of aging, when you really get to the point where it's really pretty dramatic, doesn't last that long usually. Maybe some people it goes on for a few years. Even if it goes on for 20 years, that's still fairly short in the cosmic scheme of things. So if we're willing to save up for being well off in the future, we're better off putting money in the bank of karma. Very high interest rates, guaranteed returns. Everything is compounded. But the problem is that the Bank of Karma accepts two types of deposits, white and black. So we have to look and see how much black are we putting in the bank of karma and how much white. Because if we want to have this opportunity in the future, we have to do things now. Some say they lack the provisions for Dharma practice and don't practice, but they find the provisions for committing misdeeds and automatically do them. I think for us, you know, maybe not so much committing misdeeds, but finding the money for distractions. I haven't got the money to do this program or do this teaching. But I have got the money to go out 2 times a week and have coffee and all this stuff. It's a question of choosing where we're putting the money. You have to choose where you're going to use your resources that's most important. This seems to be because rich monks and monasteries have never contemplated death and the suffering of samsara, and you important people are to blame. I say they are giving up a small household and taking up a big one. This is talking about monks in Tibet. What they do is dharma, but their ego clinging is even tighter than a householder's. This is a sign of wandering in samsara, but they do not understand that. Not finding the provisions to practice Dharma is due to not believing in the Dharma. They're afraid that practicing Dharma will make them suffer and hope that committing misdeeds will make them happy. Hoping to get their hands on some small something, they do whatever they think of in their hearts. When Geshes teach others the benefits of generosity, they all say that possessions have no meaning, saying things that seem quite true. But their innermost thoughts are focused on wealth, and that is depressing. When the Dharma and their actual practice become incompatible, how will anybody want to come listen to them? It is a sign that they seek material offerings when they say to others, give alms, do business, amass things. If you don't have a few things, the Lama will not pay attention to you, and all your friends will get angry. Their words contradict the Dharma, and that dissipates their warmth. It is certain that actions and intentions always go together. The sign that their intentions are for this life is that their actions are to work on ambitions for this life. Those whose intention is a wish for emancipation do whatever that will liberate themselves from samsara, and bodhisattvas do whatever benefit others. This is what they put into practice. So how much of what we think about is for a temporary pleasure? How much of your mental thinking goes into considering food, coffee, pleasant time with friends? How much of your conversation is about food, coffee, pleasant time with friends? And how much of it is about the Dharma? What's the balance? Let's take a few moments to meditate. Does anyone have any questions or comments or anything? I think we'll take a couple of questions or comments now, if there are. Then we'll have a short break. Yes.
So, kind of a review maybe, or just a clarification. So let's say that we choose something in our life that we feel like we have a particular attachment to, or some real something that's really, you know, causes us suffering and happiness or that type of thing. Are you suggesting perhaps that we could take that, whatever that is, and just really sort of examine that, like really sort of get to, like, what is that? How do I think that's going to make me happy? Can I play this out? What are the components of that? I mean, is that something that you're suggesting that we could sort of work on? Or
in terms of looking at your life critically, I think there's a balance. The question, if you didn't hear it in the back, is if we have a situation in our life that we're concerned about, how should we look at it? How should we examine it? Or am I suggesting that we examine those to see how we can deal with those situations? There's a little bit of a difference between the Buddhist way of approaching things and the sort of psychological way of thinking about things. And the psychological way can help and inform the Buddhist, and probably vice versa. But they're a little bit different, partially because the goals are a little bit different. It's more a question of seeing when you see something, when you experience something in your life, it's saying, okay, this confirms this teaching. Someone dies, everyone dies. This is impermanence. This is a confirmation of impermanence. Something is painful in your life. This is a confirmation of everything is everything compounded is suffering. All the aggregates are suffering. To go and sort of think, well, what is the particular sequences of causes and conditions that led to it? If you have a lot of fixation, it might help you loosen your fixation, but it might also just sort of increase different types of fixation on that. So from that perspective, it's not so important to figure out the causes and conditions. It's not specific to know that X, Y, and Z came together and produced Z, and Z is a painful situation, and therefore you need to know about X, Y, and Z and all this, which then it all comes back to your parents. I mean, it's not necessary to do that. It's to recognize that this is a painful situation, and it came about because of causes and conditions. Anything that is produced by causes and conditions is inherently suffering. It doesn't matter if it was your parents or not. In fact, it probably wasn't. They weren't under control of themselves. They were under control of their ignorance and their afflictions. So the story is not important. What's important is that painful experience is suffering, and you recognize that it is suffering, and that all other experiences are similar. Basically, you know, it's hard when you're talking about gelato to see that as suffering. But it's possible. Suffering of change. Maybe we should talk a little bit about suffering after lunch, after the break. But the point is not to go into a whole discursive narrative explanation of the different causes and conditions and all that. It's to see the nature of what it is now. Mm-hmm.